due to the length of the following CBC special presentation, Front Page Challenge will not be seen tonight, but will return next Sunday at its regular time.
Previously on Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi.
It's so big.
But size matters. That's what we're talking about.
It does. Almost anything to do with size is already a bit scary.
Ah, it's too big. It's too big. It's too big. It's too big. Oh, that wasn't big enough.
Paprika. Paprika. So, Smarties or M&M's? Yeah.
Okay.
The somewhat threatening. The
somewhat threatening Mantis.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't like the look in his eye, Mantis.
It's so big.
It's just this ugly freaking bird. Oh my God, Tokyo again! It's about giant teenagers.
Well, the running and screaming people. Oh, and he's got a t-shirt and he's sweating profusely.
Yeah, it was called
Just don't say The Legend of Boggy Creek.
No. What the hell?
Were you going to say that?
Yeah.
Paprika! Paprika!
There is no Godzilla.
You shut up. Just shut up, you.
And now, the conclusion of Size Matters.
One of the things on your list, of course, is Night of the Lethus.
Oh, so good.
Which I also rewatched, like because you said, hey, we're going to be doing this, and why not watch it? And it was on TCM. So now I didn't stick right around to the end because at a certain point I just said I had enough of these rabbits that are just regular-sized rabbits that they have a small camera making them look like they're big. And it became a point where I just said, okay, enough already.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, yeah. Because it has the giggle factor going for it, but it's a definitely diminishing returns after about, I don't know, the first 40 minutes or so. Yeah. And in fact, every time I see it or think about it, I realize that the scene in Monty Python and the Holy Grail with that rabbit that attacks is so much more frightening and vicious than anything in Night of the Lepus, which is about giant rabbits, but we get DeForest Kelly, so I'll take it.
What happened that night? Science made its greatest mistake. What unknown terror was born that night? What is the terrifying mutant that strikes from behind the shroud of night? That night of the Lepus. A night of total terror, more shattering than your strangest nightmare. What caused the unnatural death, destruction, and panic that night of the Lepus? Janet Leigh, Stuart Whitman, Rory Calhoun, and Paul Fix. Night of the Lepus. Kill one, and thousands take their place. What devil creatures growing weight and size every day are hidden behind the eyes of horror? What can stop them? Night of Olympus from MGM.
So along for the ride in this era, we get Frogs in 1972. We get Digby, the biggest dog in the world, which is not, it's not a a monster film as such, but he is attacked by the army. We get Food of the Gods in 1976.
I saw that one, actually.
Food of the Gods?
I actually saw Digby, the biggest dog in the world.
Oh, excellent. I was actually going to ask you if you did, because I only remember trailers for it. Mm. And for some reason, I was conflating Digby with Benji, which is another dog film of the time, but about a very small dog, not a very big dog. Ever see Food of the Gods, the giant rats film?
No.
Very much like Night of the Lepus, except nobody likes, you know, I mean, you know, rats are not something people are fond of the way they are fond of rabbits. Yeah, you know, ostensibly based on the H.G. Wells story, where, you know, the rats mutate, they eat this sort of food that is messed with, and they grow massive. Now, Grizzly, I watched this one recently. It came out in 1976. I love the fact that the film poster was illustrated by the great Neil Adams, who did so much great work for both DC and Marvel, and he passed away recently. Basically, it's like Jaws on land, and yeah, not very good.
This motion picture does not cater to fantasy. You will see nature's most savage man-eating animal. By its size alone, it can overpower and devour any human. Grizzly.
Hey, you got your head in the sand. We got a killer grizzly on our hands.
Scott, you're a maniac. Always we're running around in costumes. There are no grizzlies.
Oh, let's go, Sonky.
Over 18 feet tall, over 2,000 pounds, the largest carnivorous ground beast in the world.
June?
Grizzly. Anyone is fair game, because this grizzly preys on the easiest food of all, man.
Kingdom of the Spiders. The poster looked awesome. It had a massive, massive fucking spider. Yeah. And I thought, oh, I've got to check this out. And I did. But there's no giant spiders. There's just lots of spiders. And William Shatner is in it, so it was worth it for that. And now, let me see if I have a note here, because there was another big spider film that I watched this week, and it had, oh my God, why? Oh, here it is. It's called The Giant Spider Invasion from 1975, and that might be one of the films that I listed off from Mystery Science Theater 3000. It's really bad, too. It has one really big spider and a bunch of normal spiders, but it stars Alan Hale, the skipper from Gilligan's Island, as a sheriff of a small town. Guess what his first line in the film is?
No, I couldn't.
Jeff!
Hi, little buddy.
Yeah. So, how many times did he say that to Gilligan? And yeah, just the fact that they gave that to him as his very first line tells you something. All right. Well, that's sort of the end of my 70s list. And then we get into our more modern era. So Clash of the Titans came out in 1981, and it was the last film that Harryhausen was involved with. Now, I have to tell you, David, here's a little confession. For the longest time, I thought Ray Harryhausen, I thought that was three names. In the same way that, do you remember the goaltender for the Maple Leafs in the 1970s, Mike Palmer? Palmateer?
You thought it was Mike Palmateer?
Mike Palmateer. Yeah.
And then Mateer.
Yeah. Yeah. For the longest time until I clued in as a young child. But, you know, because it just sounded like so many of the French Canadian players had names like, J.P. Parisi or like Jean-Paul. You were Jean-Paul this, you were Jean-Paul that. And I thought this was Mike Palmateer. Anyway, a little bit of Maple Leafs banter there for you. So anything you wanted to talk about with Clash of the Titans where we get the Kraken?
Well, I'm still hoping for a reference to the Beatles, but the 81 film, who was the star of that? It wasn't Harry Hamlin or whoever it was it?
Oh, I'm
Clash
not
of the
sure.
Titans from 1981. Let me look that up because I remember that because the ones I think of like Release the Kraken is the more recent from the 2000s are the ones I'm thinking of with Liam Neeson and Sam Worthington and Release the Kraken. We'll get to that one in a bit.
Okay, I'll tell you what. While you're looking, I will give you a little Beatles thing that I could have thrown in here, and now I will because it's appropriate to the era that we're talking about. In 1980, the film Caveman was released. Starring Barbara Bach, Shelley Long, Dennis Quaid, and Ringo Starr. And it's a low comedy about caveman love, basically. But it involves some old-timey stop-motion animation in it with dinosaurs. And so there you go. That's your Beatles fit for this episode.
The dawn of civilization. Primitive. Dangerous. Exciting. Wet. And sloppy. Caveman.
Yeah. Atuk, Zug Zug, Lana.
He will protect them from all the beasts of the earth. Ringo Starr, Barbara Bach, Dennis Quaid, Shelley Long, John Matuszak, Avery Schreiber, and Jack Gilford. Caveman.
Yeah, so I looked it up and I know it. Most people think it was a bit odd or interesting casting, or maybe he was toward the end of his career. But Laurence Olivier was one of the stars
right.
of the Clash of the Titans from 81. Harry Hamlin, as I had remembered, Claire Bloom, Maggie Smith, Ursula Andress, and also Burgess Meredith is in it. So it's quite the cast. Like they really pull out all the stops. And it is given a 6.9 out of 10 on the ratings under IMDb, which is actually not bad. Like for a film that you think is not great, you would expect it to be a much lower score. So it might be worth a rewatch. Again, Perseus must battle Medusa and the Kraken to save Princess Andromeda, which does sound very much like the remakes, the one with Sam Worthington, which are probably better. Clash of the Titans from 2010, the same title. That's even given a less rating. Like the one with Sam Worthington is a 5.8. Even though I still love that line, the whole release the Kraken, which I always thought was like, such a great line.
And that's where that's from. I didn't realize that.
It was that moment with Liam Neeson, I think he said, because he's holding this thing backwards. You know, there's this whole situation. He just finally said, no, you have to release this massive beast. And that's something that's definitely worth on our list. Like, he wouldn't beat out Godzilla or King Kong, but the Kraken in Clash of the Titans from whenever it was, 2010 or so, is certainly one of the that would be belong in our list for sure.
Right. So in this era, we start to see fewer, giant monster films. We have some like Ghostbusters from 1984, where the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man makes an appearance in the third act as this, you know, the giant marauding, building destroying creature that comes out of Dan Aykroyd's brain. I guess both as a writer and from his character's name. From his character's brain, I should say. But it's almost like the Hollywood is waiting for the technology to catch up. So in the 90s, we do get a return of our giant monsters. So we get films like Tremors, The Giant Worms, The Graboids, Tremors. And then Tremors, of course, begot many sequels, but the original stars Kevin Bacon and Fred Ward, who we just lost 2 weeks ago from the time of this recording. In 1997, we had Anaconda, the giant snake, featuring J-Lo, Ice Cube, John Voight, Owen Wilson. Lake Placid came out in 1999 with a giant crocodile. Then we cross into the new millennium. And a film that I think I saw years ago, and you were like sort of raving about it, and I've seen clips now, and it looks really good. Eight-Legged Freaks with giant spiders came out in 2002. Among other people who are in it, we've got David Arquette and a young Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah,
you want to talk about that?
Yeah, yeah, and they've had a few spider kind of films. This one was more campy and more send-up and more humorous. And it has Kari Wurrer as the lead in it, and people may remember her from the Sliders series. Towards the end of the Sliders, when it was sort of going a bit downhill, and they were losing some of the main stars in it. And Kari Wurrer is also in the Anaconda film. She's one of the she and J-Lo are, I think, the two main women characters that are on, you know, with John Voight trying to find this big anaconda. So Eight-Legged Freaks, I highly recommend. I just can't remember the name of that other... Okay, careful. Katniss, I have this box, and I don't have the top all sealed off, and she's collapsing into it because it's just there for some storage stuff, and she's just sitting in it, and it just keeps falling into this thing.
It's like Godzilla attacking Tokyo. Now, I realized...
What was the other spider film at that time? Because there was this... There was Eight-Legged Freaks, and there was this other spider film.
Well, in the 80s, there was Arachnophobia.
Arachnophobia, that's it. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So it was Arachnophobia.
Which they actually used a spider wrangler for the hundreds of spiders that they had. And I guess we would be remiss if we did not mention Jurassic Park, which again could have its own show. But the important thing about Jurassic Park really is that we are now in the CGI era, the modern CGI era. And you know, there's the famous story about how Spielberg was really wanting to do the film, but he wasn't prepared to do it with stop motion. And he was kind of waiting for, I think it was through ILM, Industrial Light and Magic, for them to get their computer speed up so they could do it. Because that's really what it was all about. It was about processing speed. And one day he got the call, and he came in and he looked at the footage of the dinosaurs moving, and realized the kineticism had a realism to it, and that this could work. You know, this could actually work. You could create these things now, and it would look believable.
Yeah, because he was prepared. Like, the story I'd heard is very similar. Like, he was planning on actually doing it without any of the CGI, because he didn't think it was up to snuff yet. So he was fully prepared to do it with the full, you know, with the animatronics and doing all of that. And you're right, he did see the stuff. Now, my brother-in-law, Rob Sawyer, thought that, like some, obviously it's a very strong film, and the effects were amazing. But there's this scene early on with the when they're trapped in the vehicle and you see the T-Rex and
oh,
the
yeah.
eye. And the problem with the eye making itself, like it, the way the eye sort of squinted or tried to, and it came in like more like a diamond or whatever it was, he thought yes. that was off a bit because it wouldn't have been what it should have been.
Should have been more bird-like, perhaps?
Yeah, or a slightly different way that the effect would have been done. But that's a fairly small detail, because other than that, I mean, for Spielberg to pull off what was a brilliant idea, let's have a car chase in a tree.
Right. Yes.
And just the idea of that, plus, of course, a pun or a joke or just a moment when, excuse me, that's a second alarm. Because I added 15 minutes and I will set another alarm. But the now I have to try to remember what the heck I was talking about.
You were talking about Spielberg. You mentioned the race in the tree. And I think you're getting towards this humanity, you know, having jokes and whatnot.
Yes. So the joke is that you've got, who is one of the great actors. You've got the Jeff Goldblum there.
Yeah.
In the vehicle, and he looks in the side view mirror, and there's the T-Rex getting closer and closer, and there's under at the bottom of the mirror, it says objects are closer than they appear or something like that, which I thought was just a beautiful moment. And then the whole repartee, him saying move faster, you know, and all of this kind of moments that are just beautiful moments in the film.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's very much like, you know, I love the fact that Spielberg has in his repertoire, he has Close Encounters, and he's got E.T. And they're sort of like a left brain, right brain of science fiction, right? You know, one is, you know, it's as far as he goes, it's Close Encounters is kind of Kubrickian in that, like, it's got so much visual detail to it and about contact. And then we get E.T., which is also a story about contact, but almost no, it doesn't get caught up in the visual side of it. It's about the humanity and the connection of this contact between the other and us. And it's great that both of those films exist in his repertoire.
It gets a sense of almost the H.G. Wells versus Jules Verne. One is more of the science storyteller, and the other person cares more or deals more with character and other stuff, or Asimov and Clark, where you've got one that's more of the science base, and one is the more story or character based person, and you should be able to have both.
Yeah,
I think
for sure. So again, it's this recent era that we are now living in. It's almost, you know, we almost have as many films with giant monsters as we did in the Atomic Age. So we mentioned Eight-Legged Freaks. We went into that era where all of a sudden Hollywood was like, well, we've made remakes of films, we've done remakes of TV shows. Now let's do board games and toys. So we got like G.I. Joe and Battleship. And then in 2007 from Michael Bay, we got Transformers. So we had giant toys or giant product placement with the Autobots and the Decepticons come to life. And, you know, millions of dollars were spent on people going to see those films. 2007, we got from director Darabont, and why I cannot remember Darabont's first name, it doesn't matter, I guess, but he had already done two great Stephen King adaptations. He had adapted Shawshank Redemption, which is, as we know, a brilliant film. He then adapted another Stephen King prison film, The Green Mile, and his third one was The Mist, with giant Lovecraftian monsters. And in the end, we get the specifically the behemoth, which we finally see at the end of the film. And it has an incredibly disturbing ending and twist from the original. And I'm not going to spoil it for you, but...
Well, I think you've told a story about that on a previous podcast, maybe from the first season, about the experience of you seeing it, assuming that it would be closer to the story, things would work out, and seeing it with maybe your son or or child, and that was maybe
the wrong decision.
But how did you know?
I didn't, and the thing is, the rest of the film is pretty much exactly the story that I had read, the novella that I had read. Anyway, I'm going to leave that to folks at this point and on this show, because it is a great film, but it goes in dark places.
I can talk about Cloverfield.
Which we got in 2008. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause that's the thing that I mentioned in one of our episodes. Maybe it was the Beefcake Cheesecake one or the Genre Crushes, about how the party at the beginning of Cloverfield was for me, along with the Dracula 1972 film, was one of the more annoying parties. And it was just this whole beginning of it just sort of took me a bit out of the film. But the monsters, the effects that they can do with that and what you can do nowadays compared to what you could and how much cheaper they are and how good they look, reminds me of I'm trying to remember the name of the film. It was something like The Block, but I have to think about it. But it was a Jodie Whittaker film before she became Doctor Who.
Okay.
And the effects were really good, based on the fact that this is not a $100 million film that was made.
Right.
And that's what I think of Cloverfield, is that the effects for the film and what happens in it still makes me like that film.
Yeah. Now, did you see Cloverfield in the theater?
I can't remember. I would be surprised, because it's not the kind of film I would see in the theater. I would wait until it's on TV. There's certain ones like the Star Trek, whatever the recent Star Trek films and Star Wars and some other one. There's certain ones I will go to the theater for, and other ones I would wait.
Right.
And I would be surprised if I actually did. I just can't recall actually seeing it in the theater.
Yeah, I did not, but I remember thinking when I saw the trailer, I won't be able to watch this in the theater. Because it features sort of handheld video footage, because it's like supposed to be found footage of this incident. But unlike something like the Blair Witch Project, which is generally, shots of faces in the woods and whatnot, this is, really moving around a lot. Mm,
you're right.
And I thought it would actually make me seasick if I saw it in the theater. So I did stay away till I event. In fact, I saw what's the one with Cloverfield, the follow-up film.
Yeah, there was a more recent version of the Cloverfield,
which was very, very different and very, very good. Again, with one of our favorites, Mary Elizabeth Winstead. Is that her name? Yeah. And she's great in that. So I stayed away from it until it came on to a smaller screen. So we had a quote there from J.J. Abrams. He said, "I love King Kong. King Kong is adorable, and Godzilla is a charming monster. We love Godzilla, but I wanted something that was just insane and intense." And that we definitely get with Cloverfield. Mm. Also, in the sort of found footage area, we get Troll Hunter, which is a Norwegian film. It came out in 2010. And it has giant trolls. I always thought of trolls as the trolls underneath the bridge. So I always thought they were dwarfish creatures. But supposedly in Norwegian mythology, these things can be massive, like King Kong and Godzilla size. And in Troll Hunter, they are that big. And there's a hilarious little bit at the end of the credits.
Big.
It says, "No trolls were harmed during the making of this movie." 2013, we get Guillermo del Toro's Pacific Rim. And, of course, that's giant sea monsters and giant robots, men in these robot suits. And what do we call them, David? Jaegers, I believe?
Yeah, I think they refer to them as Jaegers. And yeah. That film, I know some people may not care for it or think that, you know, why should I watch this? But I thought it was a very good action film.
Yeah, and it really was like a love letter to the Toho universe. Mm-hmm. I've got a little quote here from Del Toro. He says, "I really wanted to create something new, something that was madly in love with these things," meaning the kaiju. He said, "I tried to bring epic beauty to it and drama and operatic grandeur." And I really do think he succeeded. Also, again, he's working with... who was Hellboy? What the hell's his... Ron Perlman. He was working with Ron Perlman, again, who's great in it. And, of course, Idris Elba is in it as well. And it's hard to lose with Idris Elba, who is in one of our films a little bit later, The Suicide Squad 2021. And in that film, we got a giant starfish. Let me just mention the others we have recently. And there's so many. There's we had Ant-Man from 2015 with a giant Paul Rudd. We had Okja in 2017. It was directed by Bong Joon-ho. So we got a giant pig, and we got Tilda Swinton in it and Paul Dano. The Meg, which is another giant shark film, but a really, really,
like
really
deep blue sea.
And in Dune in 2021, we had giant worms, the sandworms on Arrakis. So a lot of big things there. And also, we have talked about in previous episodes the recent Kong versus Godzilla films, or the Kong Godzilla franchise that sort of dovetailed into Godzilla versus Kong.
Rebooted at some point in the 2000s, I think. Was it Matthew Broderick, or who was it?
Well, there was a Matthew Broderick film, and I remember Ishiro Honda really did not like that film and sort of demanded that if Warner Brothers was going to continue making Godzilla films, that it needed to revamp what they were doing. So after that film, they began again. There's including the last one, the Godzilla Kong film. There's two prior to that. And then there's, of course, Kong Skull Island. And those are all a lot of fun. Like, I mean, we're talking about popcorn films, right?
Yeah. But they could have Idris Elba, who they were thinking at one point of being 007. He can do anything. So he could actually be the next Godzilla. But I don't know if you've seen this, because Alexa showed me this video on YouTube of Idris Elba talking about he can do anything. I'm mother effing Idris Elba. Like, it's himself talking about being able to do everything. And it is so, so great. It's him just having fun. It's sort of like Liam Neeson to Ricky Gervais had this series, and I'm trying to remember the name of it, but it was basically a comedian, like him and another comic, and they would just do various sketches, do various things, and one of these Liam Neeson shows up. So he sits at the table, and Liam says, I want to try a comedy.
Oh, is this Extras?
Extras, exactly. Yeah, it was from Extras. And it is so funny, but in a serious, because he can't do comedy, but that's why it's funny. Like, him doing all these lines are supposed to be funny, but he's doing it straight-faced, kind of Liam Neeson kind of things.
Oh, that would be great.
It was just fantastic. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I have a couple of other things. Actually, one is... it's a memory that I have made a note of. Marvel used to have a series of comics where I think that it was probably predominantly reprints, but it was called, it was the giant size line. So you'd get like a giant size Spider-Man and, giant size Thor, say. But one of them was, there was a comic book called Man-Thing. And it was It was created by Len Wein, who also created Swamp Thing virtually at the same time, because I think what happened was, he created Man-Thing for Marvel, and then maybe they weren't interested or something, but DC was. So he sort of respun the character as Swamp Thing for DC, and that took off. And so I'm assuming then Marvel was like, well, let's reboot this Man-Thing character, which is essentially a swamp character with, you know, a living organic green creature. But it's just hilarious when you would see these covers and they were actually called Giant Size Man-Thing. And it sounds like it might be something that it's not. Speaking of superheroes and the like, I put a little list together, certainly not exhaustive, only a couple of characters here, but of Marvel and DC characters that are gargantuan. So the biggest one that I could find was Ant-Man, who can also become small, but he talks about how he became at least 60 feet tall. So that's pretty massive. We also have Galactus, Thanos, and the Hulk, who not, Kong size, but certainly pretty big. And in DC, we have the characters Doomsday, Darkseid, and Steppenwolf, who was in the Justice League film, and he's about 15 feet or so. And then I have a couple of animated biggies. So shows that feature large characters, large, you know, friendly characters, but still pretty massive. So Gigantor ran from 1963 to 1964, and it's an early anime that was aired in America, and it was black and white. It featured a boy named Jimmy, his massive flying robot, the titular Gigantor, and his pal, again, with what sounds like maybe a stripper or porn name, Dick Strong. We also have The Great Grape Ape Show. It came out in 1975. It was a Saturday morning cartoon starring a giant purple gorilla named Grape Ape. And in 1999, the animated feature film adaptation of the Ted Hughes classic, The Iron Giant, about a boy named Hogarth and his towering alien robot friend was released. And you had a film that was similar, right, David? To Iron Man, I believe.
Well, there was
Iron Giant
some years ago was Real Steel, with I think it had Hugh Jackman in it. It's actually a very good film. It really gets to the heartstrings. A friend of mine, I think it was Jonathan Lear, mentioned how much he liked that film, if I remember correctly. Real Steel, it was around 2012 or so. I can't remember the exact year it came out. I can do a quick IMDb search to see how they rated and what year it came out, but it is a good film, and it has good 2011 with 7.0 on the rating. Hugh Jackman, Evangeline Lilly, Anthony Mackie, Dakota Goyo. But yeah, that was, it had heart, which is what you want. You want something that's got an emotional thing, and it's got a father sort of son kind of vibe going through where they're connecting over something.
How big would you guesstimate the
The robot was. It's almost like, you remember those Rock'em Sock'em robots?
Oh, yeah.
That we all had. So this thing was like that giant size. So it was sort of like it has to fight something else in a ring. And this thing might have been like 15, 20, 25 feet tall. Of course, if you're thinking about large robots or large things, just like we're talking about size matters. There was the, now I'm trying to remember the darn name of the film, but there was a film with a whole bunch of giant robots. I think it might have been Gwyneth Paltrow in it and Jude Law, the Captain Robot and Tomorrow's People or something, or Captain Tomorrow and the something or other.
Oh, is this the film with Angelina Jolie with the eye patch?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah, I always
Captain Tomorrow and the Yesterday Forevers or something. I don't know what the hell it's called.
Captain Fantastic and the, no, that's Elton John.
Oh my God.
Emergency protocol 90206, calling Sky Captain.
When the shadow of evil falls across mankind.
Come in, Sky Captain.
A bold flying ace.
This is Sky Captain. I'm on my way.
One intrepid reporter.
What's this all about?
He's coming for me.
Who's coming?
And a courageous naval officer.
What have you got me into this time, Joseph?
Nothing you can't handle, Frankie.
Are all that stand between the enemies of the future and the world of tomorrow.
Cap, this is Dex. Do you read me? Come in.
Hang on, Dex. I'm a little busy.
Jude Law.
Hold on.
Gwyneth Paltrow.
Can't anything ever be simple with you?
And Angelina Jolie.
It's a pleasure to finally meet the competition.
Joe!
I see it!
Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow.
But the robots, like if you're someone who likes robots,
I like robots. I grew up with Promo the Robot on Rocket Ship 7 out of Buffalo, New York.
Yeah, for something like that, the robots in that film are so good. It's just such, like, you have to, if you like robots, you have to see that film. The way they represent them and the story itself and everything that goes on, I think it's a very much an underrated film, I think.
Yeah, you know, it's endearing to think that there was a time when we didn't feel threatened by our technology.
Yeah, here it is. Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow. It's only given a 6.1 rating, which I don't think is fair. It's from 2004. I can't believe it's that old because, you know, a year or two from now, it's going to be 20 years. And it just doesn't seem that way. Gwyneth Paltrow, Jude Law, Angelina Jolie, Giovanni Ribisi, who I've always liked. And he's a great character. It's got that sense of the two people working together because he's sort of the science guy helping out the Jude Law character.
Yeah, and it's got that kind of cool look that I guess both Sucker Punch had as well, which I think is a Zack Snyder film.
But The Rocketeer reminds me a bit of The Rocketeer because you also have the main character in Rocketeer and the person who's helping out with the science and stuff like that.
And the fashion is retro to sort of like the 30s and 40s.
Yeah, with airships and all that. It's got that whole sense of that style. Was it almost a steampunk kind of?
Yes, exactly. It's totally steampunk.
That's like the Three Musketeers film, the four, whatever it was. They remade a Musketeer film a few years ago, and it seemed to be more steampunkish than the usual Musketeer film.
Yeah. Now, I have a quick list for you. I know you have some things to touch on, too, before we wrap up. And we've been out here in the fresh air for a long time, so... Yeah, we should think about going in and maybe playing some Crokinole. I have a short list of four actors that I just called the big guys. And feel free to chime in after I give you these four. And I've gone in reverse order. So like I go from shorter to taller. But of course, we I had David Prowse, who is 6 foot 6 inches, who gave us the embodiment of Darth Vader. He was also in Clockwork Orange and a number of Frankenstein films for Hammer Horrors in the 1970s. Now, these next two actors I often confused. There was Ted Cassidy, who was 6 foot 9 inches. He played Lurch Adams.
Didn't he play?
Lurch on the Adams Family.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he also played Jaws, did he not? Or not?
No, from that's.
The Bond film, or is that the other guy?
That's Richard Kiel.
Oh, that is Richard Kiel.
Yeah, yeah, that's the thing. See,
but
I always.
Ted Cassidy, what the heck was he in?
Well, I'll tell you. He was so Lurch in the Addams Family. He was he was on Lost in Space. He was on made an appearance on Batman as Lurch. He was in Star Trek.
Yeah, Star Trek episode. Yeah.
Yeah. The
now I understand the equation. Like he's that large guy, and they're underground, and they've got Dr. Corby, scientist Corby, and he's holding up Kirk. He says, "I understand now," kind of thing. But yeah, he's a big guy.
Yeah, and he played on both Bionic Woman and $6 Million Man. Mm. He played Bigfoot. Now, another actor also did, which I'll get to in a second.
Yeah, we know that.
Yeah, so Richard Kiel was 7 foot 2 inches, and he was Jaws in the Bond films.
Right, right, right.
He's also on our list earlier as Iga, who is a caveman that somehow, I guess, was in suspended animation or something and brought back to life. He was in the Twilight Zone episode To Serve Man as the Canimate alien who is ready to do some eating, some big eating.
Yep, yep.
And of course, you know who the biggest guy is. Right?
Yeah, now that you said that he also played Bigfoot in a $6 million Man episode, I already know who it is.
Yeah, Andre the Giant was 7 foot 4 inches and remarkably 520 pounds.
Mm.
Like that blows my mind as somebody who is and has been even bigger, 520 pounds, and he looks so solid too. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but remember that moment, which was iconic, which was isn't sort of genre, but when Hulk Hogan fought him in WrestleMania, they had to set it all up as now Andre the Giant is actually a bad guy now because he was always on the good side. And then when Hulk Hogan power slams, it actually lifts him up and slams him down. And this is a 500-pound 7 foot guy was one of the great moments in any sport, I think.
Right. And of course we know him from Princess Bride. I mean, if you didn't know him as a wrestler, which, you know, I think almost everybody does, you would know him from the Princess Bride. He was also in Conan the Destroyer, and he was the original Bigfoot on the $6 Million Man.
That's right.
An episode everybody that sort of grew up in our era really remembers that episode.
Absolutely.
So that's my
Yeah,
notes.
And there's a great documentary on Andre the Giant that came out a few years ago. He was basically someone who liked to fart in elevators. Like he has this huge meal and he let this nauseous thing go, and he'd be happy because no one else could get out. So that's the kind of style or the kind of character he was. Like he was very much a jokester and was very good natured and was a great guy. But then when you talked about, you know, how he would actually order food, it reminds me of these two Montreal disc jockeys that Howard Stern would every so often play on his show of how they ended up doing this Pavarotti thing where they were pretending to be Pavarotti and calling an order to deliver food to his dressing room. And then he kept asking all of this food and so on. Like Andre the Giant actually had the equivalent of what we would probably call like 3 or 4 meals as one meal. And he also drank many bottles of wine every day.
Wow. Right. And so he was French. Yeah.
But he had quite the appetite. But with what he had, the whole, and there's some term for it, it was basically gigantism.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. That's something like that. People generally are not long lived. You're lucky if you do get into your 40s with what he had.
Yes. Yeah. And his hands were so massive. Like I've seen a few pictures recently. And we've got a couple other points, eh, David?
Yeah. I've got just a few because we're running out of time. We're already almost past. So I've got about a minute and a half. So I'll do some quick ones. Gulliver from Gulliver's Travels, but there's a point where he is very big and tall. Buffy. And some of the things, some of the issues I have with the whole thing about the giants and trying to up yourself and do something bigger every year. Buffy had an issue with that because the first year, I think it was the Master, and they had this whole build-up, the whole season-long thing. Eventually, she has to fight the main bad guy at the end of the season. Then the next season, well, they have to find something tougher, and eventually she has to fight someone that's, I think her name was Gloria, and she was a god. And if you just keep having to do that, same thing with the Avengers films and this and that, you paint yourself in a corner. Because every film, then, you have to bring something that's even more massive and more big instead of just trying to just do another story or do something different.
Yes.
The Spider-Man with Tobey Maguire with the first film, which was great. Doc Ock, I even thought was a better film, but then they just having to keep outdoing themselves. So the third film, they had to have then two, Sandman and Venom. And I always felt that film, if it was just Sandman, would have been so much a better film. The only time I felt that a large group of supervillains actually worked well was the Batman film from 1966 that had Joker, Riddler, Penguin, and Catwoman joining forces. It's only rated a 6.5 on IMDb, but it was very good.
My point is
bigger isn't always better.
Yeah, and the thing about the IMDb rating is probably a lot of people who are much younger than us, you know, who are seeing it in a different way than we do, that's for sure. And I would also add the Legion of Doom from Super Friends, but that's a little bit different.
Now some of the things are, and because we just got like a minute left, we're already way over time, but I didn't want, you know, us to not go without mentioning Doctor Who. And there are various sites where you can actually rate that they already have ranked the Doctor Who monsters, but none of them were really big. I remember something from Planet of Evil, the Jagrafass, which were described as a lump of meat on the ceiling. The Weeping Angel, which one of the episodes with the Weeping Angel actually had the Weeping turning into like the Statue of Liberty, which was quite a moment. There was an episode called Kill the Moon, where the actual moon was a living creature. They also thought that was similar to the Beast Below, which referred to the Star Whale. Star Trek had an encounter at Farpoint where I don't want to give a spoiler, but by now people should be aware of what happens. But that's a rather large creature. There's a limit to how much we can actually cover with all of the large. I'm sure we've missed a fair number of things, but I think we've caught on the big ones. As long as you've got Godzilla and King Kong in the list, I think we're doing pretty good.
Yep. And David, you'll be glad to know that when we leave the dock and go back to the actual cottage, that in the fridge I put a couple of cream sodas in there to chill.
Very good. Thanks a lot, man.
Yeah. Well, we hope all the toffees out there enjoyed the show. We want you all to have a great summer. And if you're listening in the winter, we hope that you can let this episode be your holodeck to warmer days.
Yeah, well, that's our Size Matters show, which we just could not fit, you know, because size does matter, and you can't fit Size Matters episode into just one episode. So this is the ending of the second Size Matters. Remember to catch us on
your favorite podcast provider. You know, check out our website. I have been doing that a lot lately. I really love the website that David has set up. It's 2numeric2of.ca. You can find all of our previous podcasts there with lots of info. Also, Facebook, Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi. Please feel free to give us some feedback, chat, post something if you like, but we would love to have some dialogue going. But please do tell a friend.
Yeah, and about the website, a good friend of ours did create it, but I've been updating it since it started. We're already in season three, if you can believe it, Troy. We're in three seasons. There's a lot of content there, and if you like this episode, listen back to the shrinkage episode and all the others, because I think we have a lot of fun hanging out and talking science fiction, because we love the genre.
For sure. Yep.
Well, I am David Klink.
And I'm Troy Harkin.
See you all for our next episode of Two Old Farts
Talk Sci-Fi.